We're back here with Tim Quinn, Chief Academic Officer at Porter School in Farmington, right down the road from us. I like to be efficient with our time because you never have as much as you want. Artificial intelligence, to me, and I haven't really even engaged. I watched my son. He had to do a cover letter and a resume for a job. He's a junior in high school, and he literally had a draft in like a minute and a half. And I was like, holy crow. And I have purposely not engaged because I'm a little fearful of it. I don't know why. But I am fascinated by how, and I think a lot of institutions, we might have touched on this last time you were in, they're like, it's here. So you can't push back. You got to embrace. You got to figure out how to embrace. But for me, I worry about like our children's brains and losing the ability to do certain things that I think are kind of integral to in the world. So yeah. Like, and you spent basically a whole year trying to figure this out. I mean, I don't even know where to start. So just sort of share what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think the starting point is that you really can't hide from it. I do hear occasionally from schools who are like, yeah, we're going to keep it out and we're going to ban it and we're not going to talk about it. But it is here and it's already ingrained and embedded into so many of the tools that we use every day. So if we really want to prepare students for the future, and that's really what school is all about, you have to. I don't know if I'd use the word embrace just because that connotes a sort of love for it, but you have to accept it and you have to engage with it. So what we've been doing this year at Ms. Porter's is really trying to start to build AI literacy. And we started with the...
So you're actually teaching competency in it.
Well, with faculty. So we started with faculty because they need to learn how to use it too. And we worked with a consultant named Eric Hudson, so I got to give him credit on this. He talks about three facets of AI literacy. One is sort of a curiosity about it and just a wonder at its power. And it is tremendously powerful for people listening who haven't tried it. Like, it's not just like a calculator or a web browser or something like that.
Right.
It is amazingly powerful. So one element of the literacy is that curiosity and amazement. The second would be skill at using it, how to use it effectively to augment your work and use your time more efficiently. And then the third is to approach it with a critical mindset, because there are a lot of flaws to it. It's not perfect. It can give you the wrong information sometimes. And then a host of ethical concerns. And certainly at schools, one of the most important is academic integrity. And then even more than that, because, students are always going to try to cheat when they feel pressed for time or pressure. And, that's not a problem that's ever going to go away completely. But it is what we refer to as cognitive offloading. We want to teach them how to use AI to enhance their work and when the right time to use it will be, because There are definitely times in their professional lives they should use it, but we don't want it doing the thinking for them.
Okay, you brought up like a zillion things I want to follow up on with Tim Quinn, the Chief Academic Officer of Porter's. One is like I immediately go to academic integrity first, and I want to get to the other elements, but I always worry, forget about just the fact that I want them to be skilled in certain things. Like, part of me is like, should we do more Blue Book exams to make sure they can do certain things on their own? Or is that even that vestigial?
Well, not necessarily Blue Book exams, but teachers are definitely thinking about how to create assessments that are AI-proof, that students need to give an authentic performance, do an authentic task in real time. And that really is what shows their mastery of concepts and of skills anyways. So even without AI, that's probably a better way to assess than something that where they could use the internet. But I do think, I make the strong case that thinking about academic integrity as the sole concern is really missing the boat. That's something that's always been there, always will be a concern. Students will always find ways to cheat.
But this
is radically changing.
No, I get it. But like, I feel like there's too much responsibility on the teachers to figure stuff out, like in terms of what's authentic and not. How do they have the skill set to do that? But what are the kids using it for? I mean, are they allowed to use it for a draft on Chaucer and then they edit it? No, right? I mean, they can't do that.
That's correct. I mean, right now we're coming out with an AI position statement that's going to articulate the school's position on artificial intelligence, and then we have an AI task force that's working on developing guidelines for when and why students can use it. I think it will be different by assessment, and a lot of schools have come up with sort of like coding, like on this assessment it's okay to use it for brainstorming. On this assessment it's okay to use it to help you edit. On this assessment it's not okay to use it. You can't use it at all. So coming up with a system like that, I mean, it's challenging because it gets confusing. And there really is no way to test and see if the students have used it or not.
Well, I think your point is right. And like ultimately, you hope there's always been some kids have always cheated in school to some degree. You just what you know you want to trust your students, the majority or the not even a majority, a really high percentage, to embrace the assignments as they're given. We're talking with Tim Quinn, Chief Academic Officer at Porter's. So, can you give an example of a way, like a concrete way, that AI is augmenting like the academic experience for students?
Yeah. I mean, there are so many ways. I'll give a concrete example from a class that I teach. I teach a philosophy class, and I had the students. We read some Socratic dialogues at the beginning of the class, and they're either annoyed or intrigued by Socrates, and they want to always push back on his ideas. And so I have them each open up ChatGPT, ask it to speak in the voice of Socrates from the particular translation of the dialogue we have read, and then they have to have a conversation. They ask Socrates, ChatGPT, Socrates questions. It responds with follow-up questions. They have to respond to that, ask the next question. So they're doing this in real time, and then they print it out and send it to me, and then I can review it and assess their critical thinking.
So that's about asking the right questions and then responding to other questions in the right way.
Yeah, it's the type of thing that every teacher wishes they could have that dialogue with each individual student, but you don't have time to. So each individual student has their own personal Socrates, and it's pretty darn good that they're having this dialogue with. And it's just a fabulous way to assess thinking. And I think when you bring AI, make it a part of the assessment, they're less likely then to use it. I mean, they'd have to have another browser open with another AI.
You can't ChatGPT something to do.
I mean, you could, but it would be that extra step that you're probably not going to take.
Well, that's another thing, too, that, for years and years and years, it's sort of been Google for search and nothing else, But when we came through, remember Netscape was like a big deal.
Yeah.
And like AOL, like, is ChatGPT the industry standard? Because I know that every major tech company is trying to come up with their own AI, and from Elon Musk to Microsoft to everybody, right? So, how do you deal with that side of it? Do you have to sort of go with one?
Yeah, no, I think teachers are really experimenting with lots of different tools, and there are things like Claude, Gemini, Poe, Perplexity. Those are the other ones that compete. I do think people use ChatGPT in the way that we use Kleenex for tissues. It's just like
an umbrella.
It's ChatGPT now, but there are a number of tools, and there are they're similar, but people have their personal favorites. But I really think teachers, and this is hard to navigate with students, teachers should be using it a lot. Teaching is such a hard profession. There's never enough time. It can help them be more efficient, better at their job.
Like what? In what ways?
It can help you build lesson plans, build rubrics. You can use it to help look at student work. Never to take the teacher's place. And I think teachers get nervous about that. But it can be, it's like your own personal assistant. It can do all sorts of things for you. I make slide decks for my class, and I just make a framework, and then I put it in, and ChatGPT, I use, I can't remember the name of the one I use for that, but spits out a beautiful slide deck, and it's done in 5 minutes. What would it take me? 60 minutes.
And then you tweak it for whatever, you review it and tweak it, and then.
Always, and I think that's one of my key points for all users. You use it to produce something, and then you have to review it. But what it does is it saves me time so that I can spend more time with students and doing the things that
matter. Really quickly, we have about 30 seconds. As somebody who's a little bit averse to trying it, and you as an administrator and as a teacher and as a leader forced to engage it and figure out and use it, how does a lot of our listeners haven't yet taken that step? What is a good first step to do?
I just play around with ChatGPT.
It's an app?
It looks like a web, it looks like you'd be typing something into Google. I think it's important that some students make the mistake of thinking it's an internet search. It's not an internet search. It does have access to everything on the internet and every book ever written and, basically the sum of human knowledge. You just type in a question. And prompting, the key skill people need to develop
is the type of prompts.
How to prompt it well.
All right, we're back here with Tim Quinn, who's the Chief Academic Officer at Porter's. Listen, before we move on to some other things, anything that you didn't get to on artificial intelligence? Because I think people, even if they're not engaged, they're fascinated by it because they don't know it, so they kind of want to know. Anything we missed?
Well, I mean, just the importance of having students think about it critically as well, too, that there are flaws to it, that there are ethical concerns. So they need to learn how to use it, when to use it, when not to use it. But they also need to realize the way in which it's going to impact the world, could impact the world negatively. We have to be mindful of that.
Well, the quality of what the results are just based on the quality of the information it draws from, right?
Listen,
I want to get to, first of all, I want to update the cell phone policy. And I mean, obviously the governor, you implemented it, is it 2 years ago?
Yeah, this is our second year.
Yeah. And you know, now the governor wants, you know, public schools to do something with it, and it ranges, you know, from
Did he listen to me on your show? Is that what happened there?
Maybe. I mean, listen, it's such an obvious thing, but I think that they missed the boat. I've said this on my show. I might have said this to you. The classroom, I think, is easy. Just have them all put on the teacher's desk. That's not the hard. The hard part for me is in the hallways, in the dining hall, where people need to interact with people and hang and so on. And I mean, I think that any good teacher should be able to wrest the phones from the kids and not allow it. And the other thing is, but now that computers are a problem too, because they can do almost everything that the phones can, so they can still be screwing around or what have you. Like, how is it going?
It's been fabulous. I mean, there's definitely some pushback at the beginning and people a little concerned about it, but overall the whole community has embraced it. You know,
what is the policy? They can't use it from like 8:30 to 3 or something like that?
Yeah, 8 a.m. till 3:20.
Can they have it on them?
They can have it on them, and most of them do. And part of the reason why we allowed that is for concerns about emergencies, even though we know that really, if there's an emergency, everyone reaching for their cell phone at one time.
It's not
really what you need. But so they do have it on them, most of them. But we get, you know, visitors to our campus are you know, struck by how obvious it is that no one is on it, because we live in a world where so many people are. And it's a really wonderful thing for our community. And our kids recognize how it does benefit them and how nice it is to sit at a lunch table and just talk with their friends as opposed to all being on their phones.
And it's not onerous on the faculty to, like, because sometimes faculty doesn't want to be the bad guy to tell them, put that away, put that away, put that away.
Yeah, and that was one of the biggest hurdles to getting to this place. And that's why we used to have the policy before that was sort of like, at this time, in this place, you couldn't have it. And then there was so many gray areas, and that made it harder for the faculty, you know, because there was this gray area, and then they felt like the bad guy. But we just weren't so clear with this. And there was a time in the beginning where there were more phones confiscated, but now it's pretty good.
Have you learned anything that you maybe unintended consequences, or anything that as it evolves you'll change? I mean, is it as it is, you like exactly the way it is?
I mean, I'd like to get it off their person too, because I, you know, there's no doubt that they are probably using it in the bathroom and sneaking, you know, and that, you know, that's fine. We've definitely reduced the overall time on cell phones, but I think it would be great to have it so it's not on their person, so they really have a whole day without it. And we're a boarding school, so we're looking at how we can take it away at nighttime too, so they can get better sleep. Our health director is really looking into that, and that's, you know, she believes that's an important next step.
I think it's a great point. My daughter, we lost the battle, and she would refuse to, on a lot of nights, keep it aside. But both our boys put it in the kitchen overnight, and I think it matters. I wish they would do a little reading before bed as opposed to looking at it before bed, but they still, it's not in their room, so they can grab it first thing when they wake up, which I'm guilty of myself. Tim Quinn here, the Chief Academic Officer at Porter's. We have a couple of items up for bid, but we're going to have a bigger segment. Matt, we got to go now? Yeah, so we'll take a quick break here. I want to touch on recruiting and teachers because I'm curious about A, the talent pool, B, the gender breakdown of that talent pool. Are there enough males in the teaching profession? I mean, Porter's a little different because it's all females, but I find in other schools it's difficult to attract male teachers. Maybe that's something that you want more of that you don't have. I don't know. And also DEI. I mean, we've had a lot of interesting conversations here on the show about, you know, a lot of the pushback in the administration, but I find also a lot of people think that it's a good moment to reassess how we approach this stuff. So I know you have a lot of thoughts on that. We're here with Tim Quinn, Chief Academic Officer from Porter's. I want to talk about teachers. You know, I was a crappy teacher. I did it. I've taught a couple of different stints. I did it at Taft right out of college, and then I taught some new media journalism stuff at Springfield College when I started on my journalism career. And, you know, to be a good teacher, it's like being a parent. Like, anyone can teach, but very few people can teach well. You know what I mean? I just feel like it's really hard to be a great teacher. It takes a lot of work. They're under a lot of scrutiny. Public schools, a lot of people feel underpaid. Are you seeing, you've been in this world for a long time now, is the number of candidates, quality of candidates, like, how has it changed over, say, the last 15 years?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to start by underscoring what you said. Teachers are overworked and underpaid, and it is, you know, one of the most important jobs in our society, and we need to value it more, and we don't. And because of that, the pool of teachers and the people who want to become teachers is smaller, and that's unfortunate for students, and it's unfortunate for society, because when we have good schools and good students, it helps society as a whole. I would say right now, I feel like the teaching pool is as small as I've seen it. Now, we're a unique school. We're an all-girls boarding school, and to work at a boarding school is a very particular choice. You want to buy into an all-in lifestyle, which has tremendous advantages, I think, in terms of the lifestyle and the benefits, but it is a huge commitment of your kind of whole self to developing these adolescents. So the pool is small, for sure.
And in terms of, does that mean you have to go down the qualification spectrum? Like, are you giving jobs to people that you wouldn't give jobs or considering them, you know, 10 years ago?
No, I don't think. I thankfully, it has not dropped where the people we end up hiring are still really strong. But I just feel like there were a lot more strong applicants, certainly pre-COVID and much earlier.
Do you believe it's cyclical, or do you think, you know what I mean? Like, will there be something? Because when I was in education, my father always like, well, maybe the level of education would slip and then there'd be more private sector interest and somehow it would push wages up. It never really happened. But is it cyclical, or is this something that's...
Well, I mean, I hope it's cyclical. It's hard to say for sure. Right now, education, as you said, teachers have never been under higher scrutiny. The whole, you know, it connects to artificial intelligence too. To tie it back to that, people are questioning what is education. What are schools even going to look like in 20 years? We might be losing our Department of Education. So people are wondering how valuable are schools. I think people ask these questions like, what are schools for? What do we want them to do? Do we even need them? These are actual questions that people are asking. So which all I think give reason why it might give someone pause before becoming a teacher. But it's a great... I mean, I encourage anyone listening to become a teacher. Yeah. It is no better, more noble profession.
My wife is a lifelong educator, and we're surrounded by them a lot. And it is a great life if it's the life you choose and commit to. There's no doubt about it. But I think that in terms of like respecting the classroom, which you may not have as much challenge with as maybe some public schools, but it can be a deterrent for people who just like why put up with that stuff. But I feel like there's a bit of a turn. It seems like they're coming back a little bit. But listen, Tim Quinn, Chief Academic Officer at Porter's here in Farmington. It's an all-girls high school right in our backyard, right on Main Street. Beautiful, beautiful spot, by the way. I just love that Main Street in terms of like the old colonial buildings and so on. DEI is under huge fire from the federal government on down. And the conversations in some ways at some level feel like they could be healthy, right? Because it's always good to audit and review how things are. But I mean, how is this pushback on DEI on specifically on academic institutions, how does that impact, where you are?
Yeah, well, as a private institution, thankfully, we're allowed to make our own decisions on a lot of those things. So our commitment to principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion remains strong. I think, in my perspective, a lot of the pushback, the honest pushback, at least, I would say it was motivated out of the fact that in some places, DEI or DEIJ, it gets lumped together.
What's the J?
The justice.
Okay.
Some people put in DEIB, which was belonging. Those concepts got lumped together into one entity that in some places took on a political ideology. And I think what we need to do as schools, where we should remain committed to those as those individual concepts, is simply break them apart. When people refer to DEI, they mean a very specific thing, often some sort of left-wing political ideology. It doesn't have to mean that. We know that diversity makes any organization stronger, that you have a better education in a diverse environment. What school wouldn't want students to feel included and to treat them fairly? So all those concepts are so important to any school. So we need to remain committed to those. But I think we can, by breaking them apart.
How do you do that? So do you get rid of the title? In real terms, how do you break it out and depoliticize it?
you know, I think if I haven't had to think through that, because at our school we're not, you know, required to necessarily change the title. But I do think at a school where that's the case, that would be helpful. You can use all the same practices often without, you know, having this umbrella term that has become overly politicized.
Yeah, it's one of those things where when you put it that way, although you know, in terms of diversity, equity, inclusion, you address, you know, diversity and inclusion, and the equity part is hard. I mean, some people the pushback is, I don't know, it's just a hard subject. We're sitting here, we're two white males. I say all the time, I have had ridiculous privilege. I'm not wealthy, but I mean, I can't deny the degree of privilege I've had in my life. I mean, I don't know how I can't, you know, so like, I mean, it's one of those things where to meet all the parties in the middle. And I understand some of the pushback, but I think that people need to recognize how ridiculously privileged they may or may not be.
Yeah, and that's when the pushback from extremely privileged people lands kind of doesn't land well.
But it's a tough topic to even talk about.
It is. Yeah, it's politically fraught. But it's good that we can have the conversations, and I think it's important that people have the conversations. And that seems. You know, I don't know if it'll swing back the other way, but certainly in the years since COVID, it seemed like there was more of an ability to have open conversations about some of these things, open, honest conversations. And that, as an educator, more than anything, that's what I am a proponent of, open, honest conversation.
I agree. Tim Quinn, Chief Academic Officer at Porter's, sort of last question is, anything trend-worthy, like what kids are doing or interested in? Are people really pushing away the humanities in favor of more career-focused stuff? Or I listened to Plain English with Derek Thompson about kids aren't reading books, like even classes aren't reading books. They're just doing excerpts, and they go to college, and they haven't read a book, even if they're super-duper talented students. Just give me something.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, all of those things are true, and all of those things we can push back against, and good schools do. And I think it's and this also speaks to what we were talking about cheating and academic integrity in the beginning. If you make learning relevant for kids and you give them tasks that they actually enjoy and feel are meaningful, they're going to do the right thing, and they're going to learn, and they're going to develop the skills they need. So that's the real task for schools right now, how to make school relevant for students. And there are so many great ways to do it. Make it meaningful. Give them some autonomy over their education. And that's going to go a long way to making it a positive experience for them, which will lead to better results.
That's not easy to do. I mean, that's your job, though. That's your life.
That's why teaching is hard.
Yeah. Tim Quinn, Chief Academic Officer at Miss Porter's, or I don't want to insult it because it's Porter's on the branding, but it's always Miss Porter's to many people.
Miss Porter's is fine, yeah.
An all-girls boarding school in Farmington, Connecticut. We appreciate the time, bud. It's good to see you.